Go ahead and bow our heads together in prayer and settle our hearts spiritually. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to labor together and work together and lay our treasures up in heaven. Allow our hearts to be open to you. Give us wisdom. Give us discernment. Give us encouragement. Let us be of use in the kingdom. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so the last couple of classes, we've introduced Joshua. We've talked about the transition from Deuteronomy to Joshua. We've found ourselves walking with the spies into their first encounter with the people of the land. We've met Rahab and explored the interaction between Rahab and Israel. We've noted the covenant relationship those two parties engage in, the two spies and Rahab. They basically create a binding covenant. And that covenant is connected with consequences due to guilt. It's an important kind of premise or framework that takes place in a lot of the interactions from this point forward. When you if you pay close attention to the conversations that take place between maybe some of the families of Israel, the various kings, you'll note them kind of engaging in this same kind of banter. And we can kind of call it banter because in the writings of this period and also in the text itself, you see them doing this kind of thing often. We do the same things. We talked about it. We used a kid-level illustration of the pinky swear and the fingers behind the back as the two methods culturally appropriate for children to talk about promises or broken promises. That's kind of what you see whenever there's a covenant commitment between two people from this point moving forward. Always, though, when we're talking about Israel, there's a third party in their covenants. It's the same thing we noticed before when we talked about the law and its placement in the ark. And there was a double copy placed in the ark. Who's the third component of an Israelite covenant? Jehovah. God is their third partner. But that's not uncommon, because in all of the ancient Near East, God, their God was always the third component. If you remember, the contractual arrangement outside of Israel was one copy got put in the temple of the party A's city, community, nation. The other copy got put in party B's temple, the city, nation, etc. In the case of Israel, with their covenant with Jehovah, both copies went into the ark. So that kind of ties together with kind of where we're at. They're now going to be making a couple of cyclical entries into the land, and there's some important things to kind of think about. Joshua 3, 4, and 5 at times hop back and forth from different parts of what we would consider the timeline narrative, the this, then that, then this, because there's sections that kind of look this way. Picture it as if you're filming something, an event, a circumstance, a setting, with just one camera. And that one camera is trained in on this event, and then you find out there's something else going on, and the camera goes, stuff still happens over here. It's just not on the camera anymore. And then eventually the camera will come back and present itself to that position and place again. There's lots of movies that are filmed that way, television shows, etc., that have that one camera view to things. Well, this section of Joshua has a one-camera view to some of the events that take place. So in the first section of the text, we're going to have some events take place, particularly when I talk about the first section, I'm talking about verses 1 through 13. That's our first chunk of the text. By the way, I won't ask it this way, but sometime maybe I will. Imagine me asking this question. Did you read chapters 3 and 4 before the class? And would you raise your hands if I asked that question? Don't do that. Nobody's on the spot. You're fine. But that's basically our homework. And we want to encourage everyone to have read the text, listen to the text, have it ringing in the back of your head. That will gradually help stabilize you into this study and kind of see where everything is. So if we have a couple days between each of these sessions and we only have a couple chapters to read, read them regularly. Make it be a return visit to have that message bouncing around in the gray space of your head so that it's fresh and it's familiar and there's no surprises. So chapter 1, Joshua rises early, and he's going to basically begin to create the staging, if you will, of things going over. We talked, and we may mention this specifically, on our perception of Moses versus Joshua. The Bible shows us, both in the Old Testament, in the first five, but also from Joshua to John, and from John to Jesus, that Moses is like the high point of prophets. Nobody else like him. Nobody's better than him on the earthly plane, and everything else is comparative to him. What's interesting is that in chapter 3, Joshua gets to have his Moses moment in very much the same context. If you'll notice, and we'll read this right now, Joshua 3, verse 13. Michael, could you read that for us? Yeah. I want you to think about that quick literary and God doing the same things concept. Is that familiar? Yeah, it's really close to the Red Reed Sea crossover context where you have them dry landing. But now it's Joshua telling them that this will happen. So now you're the priests. Your responsibility is to carry the ark. And you're walking up to the Jordan. Let's kind of imagine, if you will, the process there. You've got the ark properly carried, the poles, everything's perfect. You're a Levite, and you're walking out, and you're about to do your first step. What do we call that step by? It's a step of faith, right? But now they have to trust a new prophet, a new spokesman for God. And everything hinges on that guy. We sometimes focus on the big premise of what it would be like to be the high priest, what it would be like to be Joshua, what it would be like Moses. What about that guy? Who is the literal lead-off emotionally to, is this Joshua real? Is he actually going to be good? I mean, I know Moses said, I know that God is. It seems to be connected to Moses, and Moses said, but right here it's, wait a minute, let's see what happens. And so that's a great layered look at how God then does something we see a lot. And we talk about this when we say, what's a miracle? What do we sometimes use as an alternate definition to a miracle? Right, so yeah, certainly they're constant, they're regular things. They are extraordinary and they're amazing. But what's the purpose of those miracles? That's kind of the alternate definitions. Why do we have miracles? Well, a sign that we believe that we can use the miracle, whether the miracle is foretelling the future, whether the miracle is raising someone from the dead, whether the miracle is crossing over a dry land, to determine, hey, which side is this guy on? Is he on the Lord's side? Or is it something else? So much so that when the Pharisees meet Jesus, what do they do with it? Oh, there's no way he's on the Lord's side. He's doing this by whose power? Satan's power. And so they have to change the story, the narrative, and say that, well, this is clearly the devil's work. Because everyone else is going like, well, wait a minute, he did a sign. And we know that signs come from God, and he said this, so we should believe this. That's the cycle there. Well, now Joshua is being elevated in that same capacity in this text. And so a lot of what you see in the first sections, in the first segments of these steps forward, the faith to step the next point on the journey, if you will, are going to create that opportunity. Do we trust Joshua? Because Joshua is now telling us that God says, God wants us to do, God tells us to go. This is on the backdrop of all those reminders from Moses. Hey, keep your word, follow through, keep your commitment. I'll introduce something to you here The text is going to give us, this is verses 14 of chapter 3 through 14 of chapter 4, a little tiny appetizer sandwich. Because last time we had a bigger sandwich, right? Where things moved into the meat of the middle of the second chapter, where you had the confession and commitment of Rahab. Well, here you've got a small one. 14 through 17 of chapter 3 is the first portion of crossing over. Then you're going to have the big interlude of chapter 4, verses 1 through 10, which is the 12 stones. A lot of symbolism that's going to take place there. And then it goes back to crossing over. So you have the camera pan effect taking place here. Look over here. And now look back over here. Kind of gives you some nice structure to see all of these points come together and tie together. All right, so zoom back out. We've looked closely at verse 13 to see this taking place. Now look back at verses 1 through 6 of chapter 3 to help walk us through the text. The section here really kind of begins with maybe an idea of keeping your distance in some sense, but following Jehovah. As always, when mortal forms get too close to God, what happens? Well, yeah, like your unholiness defiles it so much that you are not able to be in His presence. You look in the Old Testament, particularly around the tabernacle, and they were to touch the holy things, dead. Get too close to the wrong areas, dead. Like literally, proximity mattered for the tabernacle. Proximity mattered for closeness to the, both the presence of God as a cloud and the presence of God as a pillar of fire. And so they couldn't get too close. They couldn't even handle second-hand exposure to God. Moses, your face is too much. Cover that up. We can't handle that. So they couldn't have, like, we talk about second-hand smoke. They couldn't handle second-hand God. They just couldn't deal with it for lots of reasons, both spiritually, but also probably some practical sides as well, because the text seems to indicate some practical levels to it. So chapter 3, verse 3 is maybe some of the things we can identify here. It says, Joshua is making a command to the people. He says, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, or the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. All right, so now they know what to look for. We already read ahead and know that's going to plow the road. It's going to clean the land in the sense of making it able for them to cross over. And so they're watching for that. It's kind of an obvious thing. A good sign also to know to stay this way theologically that God goes before them. Their commitment, in this case, is very specific. Because the covenant is stored inside of the ark, it also says that their commitment goes before them on a theological level. Their promise, their pledge, that goes out first. And so you have that kind of picture bringing them into the land. And Joshua is telling them, look for that, be aware for that, because that's the first thing of notable importance for us. Eventually, by the way, how pivotal is the Ark of the Covenant to the military success of this Israel? And I say this Israel as contrasted to the Israel of the United Kingdom and the Israel of the divided kingdoms. So is it little important or a lot important, the Ark of the Covenant? Sometimes it seems like it's essential. Like it's like the almost, so very important is the starting point and maybe the most important thing in some ways. Obviously, it only has power on the basis of Jehovah. Like it in and of itself isn't some magical weapon. It's just a box. It's never shown to be of power to anybody else but God dispensing through it and His presence. But it matters. Even in the sense of the consequence of mishandling it, if we think forward or back at different points of the interaction of God's people with it. And eventually it vanishes from history. Where it's gone. Like a lot of Old Testament era Israel is gone. It's gone to antiquity and to history. But right now, it's really the signpost of, hey, Jehovah is coming. It's time to get out. This ties in well with the story that the spies brought back. Hey, look, you know, they all know we're coming, and they already know that everything melts before you. And they're speaking to Jehovah through Joshua in that conversation. All right, so another fact you'll see in this text as well. There's going to be a repeated phrase of that. The ark, by the way, is mentioned, I think, maybe up to, in connection with the covenant specifically, like 17 times in this section of the text. To kind of see how important those two things are. If also, just for our perspective, it stands as a contrast to some of the ways in which the gods of the Canaanites were perceived. They were perceived in more likely to be in a given locality fixed to their sacrificial grounds or altars. And Jehovah is shown to be mobile with Israel. Of course, Israel's mobile as well. They are moving people. But we move forward in the text. We kind of think forward to this event in the crossing point they're looking for. Here's our ark. It's about size, about the right size, approximately. And it finds itself carried by the Levites to the middle of the Jordan. But this also symbolizes that Jehovah is there. So it's a visual representation of who is holding back the water. Because it's not really Joshua. It wasn't Moses. Neither of those things were actually them doing the thing, right? But it's not the ark either. Is the ark holding the water back? Is the Jordan like 4 feet wide? Even if the nasty Jordan we get to see today, it's not 4 feet wide. But who's holding the, who's stacking up the water? Yeah, the work of God. It doesn't tell us exactly all the hows, because sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. It's just that he's doing it. He's cutting it off so they can cross over at a point that's that would normally not be accessible. So there's a great pictorial or theological aspect of that as well. Verse 4 continues, by the way, in the text. It says, "Yet there shall be a distance between you and about 2,000 cubits, you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before." All right, so have the Levites been spies? Think this through. Are the Levites going through? Have they spied the land? No. But everyone else is told to hold back. So the Levites are being instructed for the benefit of nobody else, for all the others who didn't go through. The Levites are told where to go, but they can also use that as a second sign. Okay? We go when they go, but also we follow them and we look and we know, again, that Jehovah is there. He is identified in that second layer, if you will, of the picture. Let's move forward now, and we're going to actually scoot forward to just after verse 13 and look at verses 14 through the end of chapter 3 together. Steve, first. Read on. Yeah, that's really the connector. We've kind of been highlighting that this is, we'll stop and make a little side journey because Steve's right. Initially, Moses, signified as the leader of Israel by Jehovah through the miracles that took place. Moses then signifies that Joshua will follow. God now is signifying that Joshua is leading, but also that God is with them. That all of this is to exalt and to glorify God. Verse 8, it follows on. "And as for you, command again the priests who bear the ark of the covenant." You see that covenant or the ark picture coming up again and again and again in this chapter. All right. Verse 17 really starts the literal crossing over section. Actually, verse 14, that is, through the end of the chapter, is like them actually making those steps. Jordan, you want to read that part for us? 14 through the end of chapter 3.
"So it lets
So, just a kind of quick summary to kind of tie it together. Verses 3 through 7, like Steve pointed out, exalts the servant of Elohim or Yahweh. Verses 10 through 13 then assured us of Elohim or Yahweh's power, that God had the capacity to do so. But in verses 14 through 17, you have an otherworldly nature of the method of God. It's strange. There's an oddity to it from the perspective of mankind. Mankind doesn't do things the way God does all the time. If you were to talk to random people about, do you understand why God chose to save the world the way He did with His Son? Do we all have good answers for that? Like, I don't have a great... I have answers. I don't know if they're the complete answers. But it's very complex, right? But even more than that, add a couple more layers. Why did God destroy the earth with water? Why did He choose that way, the generation on there? Well, that's the thing, but why water? Why not fire? Why, you know, He doesn't do the things the ways that men want to. Because man might all say, why destroy it all? Why not just fix them? Just turn a switch and make them better. That's where we get to. And so we encounter often God's doing something that may not make sense on the earthly level. It might make sense in the rear view. Okay. That's why He did that, because He'll tell us. But sometimes, we just don't get the answers we're looking for yet. And I'll say yet, and maybe not at all. Maybe it's something that is not necessarily an answerable thing from our perception. We don't have the capacity to see as God sees. I'm not eternal. I'm not divine. I don't have those abilities. I have the Word, and it gives me as many answers as I can find. So, even in this process of them crossing over and keeping those distances and being able to reasonably catch some of those details, not all of it's spelled out to us. Because why not just build a bridge? Or raise up the earth? Or what? Any number of possibilities on the human side. But He does something strange. It's strange from the worldly standpoint, but it does make sense that God has the capacity to do so on a couple other levels. Right, that's the other end of the story. One of the things I try to do is try to walk like an Israelite through the event, especially as we teach it, because I know what they don't know. I've met Jesus in the Scriptures, and so I see a lot of things, and we talk about them at the end of our classes usually. But they don't know who Jesus is. They barely, in some ways, are at the thimble full knowledge of who Jehovah is, even though He's cared for them and protected them. And you can see that kind of in their behavior as well. All right, the next section of this portion of the text is verses 1 through 10. We've got the 12 stone perspective or setting taking place. And in that, this section went from exaltation of the servant, the assurance of God's power, the strangeness of His method, and then another suggested way to think about it is in this portion here where the 12 memorial stones are laid out, these are reminders of God's goodness that Jehovah has provided for all in every inch of these steps or processes they're walking through. So a couple things you can kind of see in the text here as sequential ideas. would start there in verse 1, but maybe even we can highlight verses 6 through 7. Ariel, would you read that for us, verses 6 and 7 of chapter 4? All right, so that's the purpose of the memorial on a basic level. Quick question. Does Israel remember? Do you or I remember? When you were reading through Joshua 3 recently, were you like, I forgot that happened a second time? You don't have to answer the question. But emotionally, you can work yourself. I forgot that happened. You know? It's okay to acknowledge forgetfulness. That's how we are. We're people. We forget stuff. Even if we're great Bible students or regular readers or whatever, we miss details. So a memorial makes sense, right? Like having a reminder. In your life, you have memorials all the time. You've got a to-do list, right? That's literally in part the same premise or purpose. These are important. I want to remember them because I need to do them. In part, the memorial that's placed here is a connection between remember, but also a do. Because this is a stepping forward by faith moment for them. So if you go to the stones, and you're there with your family, and you're telling them, hey, this is when grandpa, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandpa crossed over. And these stones are to help us remember that story. How many grandpas are they going to try to encourage their kids and say, or their grandkids or whatever, and now we got to go and live likewise and go do. So that's part of the purpose there. But Israel doesn't do that. The Israel we meet here from chapter 4, close to Joshua, the beginning of Judges, it's like, where are those stones? Who are these people? Reminder for us, at least on a simple level, is that we're as equally fallible to forget the great things that God has done for us and with us, and often make the very same mistakes that they did, and the same mistakes we make, we repeat them. We're going to get in those same kind of cycles. There's some assumptions beyond that, and I've kind of highlighted one of the what I think is, at least on a surface level, one of the greatest challenges to faith is forgetfulness. Forgetfulness of basic blessings. The simple illustration for that for me is one of my aunts used to give all the grandkids tube socks for Christmas. And I'll tell you, as a grandkid, tube socks are not high on our list. But you know what grandkids don't understand is that how much tube socks cost for her, my aunt. And if we were there at my grandparents and we're getting all these tube socks, right, like for her that was a very expensive gift to give to all of those nieces and cousins and all that stuff. But for me it was like tube socks. Right now, I wouldn't mind getting tube socks from her again. It's a good memory. We forget that at different points in our life. We forget the value of things. But what else in the text here? What else do we see in the crossing over of Israel into Jordan that serve as memorials for us of things we should remember? First layer is, if I'm Israel, what should I remember from here? What are some important things? And the second layer is, we are Israel, we're spiritual Israel. What should we remember now? So, if you stay close to where the ark is, you got protection, you got safety and security. Yep. Completed promises. From the very first day that Jehovah tells a man to take his family to Canaan, and his family becomes Israel, now they walk in. Now they come in. What else? Michael. Yeah. Yeah, we found it all the way out there. I can't even swim out there because the Jordan was wide compared to how it is now. Bobby, you had your hand up. Yeah, there's a great pictorial aspect of this. We move to the other side about cleansing and washing that takes place in these under submerged illustrations, whether it's Israel crossing through on dry land, both with Moses and now again with Joshua, whether it's the purging of rebellion on the earth with Noah, and whether it's the reconciliation that takes place between Jesus or his work for us through Jesus and God. And so all of those have great connectors as good reminders as well. Jordan?
When I try to connect with us about how they pass through the water in front of my kids,
Right. They've on one level, there's a slight complacency to the consistent providence and care of God. That on a regular basis, he's fed them, he's clothed them, he's sustained them. But now it's like the fireworks are going off on a regular basis and saying, here's God here, here's God over there. One more aspect of it, if you remember back as a parallel principle, when Israel crosses over from Egypt into Exodus, if you will, it's important and imperative for Moses to be able to stand. You'll note that this time the picture has shifted. It's similar, but not the same. But it's important that the ark stay in position, and that the Levites are sustaining it versus Moses. And I think that's a great shift theologically to pay attention to, because that shifts the weight off of one man and begins the next layer of worship in the development of Israel. Up until Moses, and really even inclusive of Joshua, religion in Israel is heavily patriarchal. It's every patriarch is also a priest. Pretty much that's the standard model from the garden to the law. From the law to Jesus, the patriarchal priest really vanishes as a regular relationship between Jehovah and man. And so right here when they cross into the promised land, there's a structural reminder that things are shifting a little bit. It's not about one man. Now the tribe, which that tribe also would have all those responsibilities, are having that spiritual level of connection. So even as much as it exalts Joshua to have this take place, the tribe of Levi becomes the vehicle or lever by which God's work takes place. And it stays that way. It's a consistent thing. It's an expected thing all the way through until the arrival of Jesus. The Levites were still expected to be the conduit, if you will, of information, of instruction, of education, of encouragement, of discernment in spiritual things, even though the king would have a role later down the road, even though the prophets would have roles spread out, even judges. But judges don't always look the same way as we think they ought to when we encounter them next. Next section of the text kind of pops up around verse 18. Let's go ahead and read that one real focused-wise. Steve, would you read verse 18, chapter 4?
And when the priest carrying the ark of the covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of
Just got to picture that, at least for me visually, to think about walking through like Israel. And so here's number one Levite priest walking in. He's got the ark with him, however they're arranged. And he steps. And the water just pulls back. And they make their way to the middle of the Jordan. And they're standing. They're waiting. Doing what they got it asked. And then as they last one, now I'm in the back. It's the last foot leaves, the water returns. That's a really powerful picture that God's doing, and it's a different kind. We tend to think of God up to this point as big fireballs of fire from the sky, or creation narratives, or even the plagues. This one's modest, yet amazing. Because if you're standing out on the shore, and you see that foot rise up and leave and go to the shoreline, and God's work says, okay, I'm done. It's a soft exit to a powerful God. And now they're moving forward. But He's reassured them that my hand is definitely there. Verse 19 continues forward, and you see the trust of Jehovah. We talked about this a couple different ways on how His promises and pledges are coming to pass. Verse 19 of chapter 4 reads this way: the people came out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones, what they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know. Israel passed over this ground on dry this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dries up the waters of the Jordan until you passed over, as the Lord God your God did to the Red Sea, which He dried up for us until we passed over. That all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So in Joshua 4, it tells us at least the big application point of the memorial. Yes, Red Sea, Jordan. Same type. But the message wasn't just for Israel. It was for everyone to know that the Lord was mighty. The Lord was, His hand was powerful. And to prepare and expect that to continue. Right. So it kind of like, over the years, people have questioned, well, how did that happen? And sometimes people will search for an ordinary explanation to an extraordinary event. They'll say, I don't want it to be a miracle. Is it possible there was a drought? Or is it possible that the route they took had low water and it was just really, really low that day? The repetitive nature of it, at least from the standpoint of seeing God tell the story, is He's saying these are extraordinary. And here's evidence of this extraordinary case. And also, for our purposes, the people surrounding this event, the nations around it, this is going to be something that is a story that could get told. Hey, wait a minute, remember that day of the Jordan? Wasn't normal. That was the day that Israel crossed over. Oh, it's definitely for the Israelites there. And one thing with like Pharaoh, we often talk about him as if he's a robot and had no control over his behavior. What you see in the Pharaoh is the opposite response of what you see in Moses and the people and all of the non-Israelites who are also slaves. Pharaoh gets tough through the same pressure that softens the hearts of the rest of the slaves in Israel to trust Moses and to trust God. In a practical way, it's the exact same thing that happens to us when we encounter matters that challenge our faith. They will either harden us toward the world or soften us toward God. Nothing has changed about that, and as much as we want it to be different, it's still the same. So now we have an Israel who has crossed over, who is preparing to do some amazing things. Just as a hint, what happens in chapter 5, 6, and 7, or some stories from the scriptures that will be on our table. All right, first thing we have is circumcision. When we talked about this before, we tend to think of circumcision as a couple of things. I was going to hint at it. We're going to talk about it more in detail on Sunday. Well, we think about it as, well, that just means you're like an Israelite, and that's all that it is. It's not that, because only half of Israel gets circumcised. Only the males were circumcised. Further, it has nothing to do with their faithfulness. Yes, they needed to do it, but being circumcised didn't keep them faithful, did it? No. In fact, there's some other layers that the New Testament shows that are equivalent to that about our circumcision, which is made without hands, which is what? I'm hitting at it. Baptism is a parallel principle in the New Testament. The circumcision made without hands really is baptism in many ways, and it has all those same theological components. But that's it for right now for class time. So we have to stop right here and close up on chapter 4. Chapter 5 will be the beginning point for our study on Sunday morning. And thanks, everybody.